The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. All right, let's start off with a drama in real life. Rescue on the High-Rise Bridge. With his truck dangling 70 feet above a rolling river and a storm whipping 50-mile-per-hour winds, a trapped driver's only hope is a team of trained emergency rescuers who are stuck in traffic. The winds this April morning were giving Wayne Boone's massive 207 Freightliner tractor a trailer a good lashing. A driver for Butler Paper Recycling in Suffolk, Virginia, Boone steered the empty 18-wheeler up a stretch of Interstate 64 in Chesapeake toward Virginia Beach, about 25 miles away, where he would pick up the first load of the day. The 53-year-old driver pulled into the eastbound left lane of the GA Treacle Memorial Bridge, known to locals simply as the I-64 High Rise, a four-lane drawbridge that traverses the southern branch of the Elizabeth River. Actually, I've driven across that. On the span, the storm let loose its full force, finding no obstacles in its path but vehicles, which it pummeled. Rain hammered Boone's windshield. Winds grew fiercer. Boone slowed, letting cars pass. It would be good to get on the other side. At the bridge's crest, 70 feet above the rushing estuary, the concrete road gives way to steel decking. Even in perfect weather, it's easy to lose traction on the grids. Boone's front wheels met the slick steel just as a powerful gust blasted the driver's side. To Boone, it felt as if the wind lifted his truck clear off the surface. He could swear he was floating for a second before being dumped to the right lane. He had no time to consider how such a thing could be possible. His cab barreled into the guardrail on the far right edge, banging the metal barrier that protected his truck from pitching into the water below. He struggled to regain control. His empty trailer, meanwhile, jackknifed in the left, skidding sideways at an angle to the cab. Fighting both truck and the weather, the steering wheel unresponsive, Boone was swept along about 200 feet, unable to get any traction. Then a second gust, raging more violently than the first, blew the open mesh of the bridge's steel gird. It slammed into the driver's side of the cab and simultaneously shoved it upward from below, lifting the cab with Boone inside over the edge of the bridge before dropping it again. If he had any hope of survival before, it was gone now. The cab was now aimed straight down toward the gray-black water. Lieutenant Chad Little of the Chesapeake Fire Department was on his way to conduct a CPR training class when an odd message popped up on his SUV's touchscreen. Truck hanging over the bridge. He was only a minute or two away. He flicked on his emergency lights and siren and sped to the high-rise. Traffic on the bridge was impassable. Little got as far as the drawbridge's grid and no farther. When he stepped outside, the wind blasted him. He tucked in his chin and walked ahead about 75 yards and radioed in his assessment. The front cab of a tractor-trailer had gone over the high-rise, leaving its trailer still on the bridge. The heavy steel frame between the cab and the fifth wheel, where the cab couples to the trailer, had literally folded, and the cab, bent at a 90-degree angle, dangled over the river. Engine, hood, and fuel tanks had already fallen, leaving a slick on the water. The driver was trapped in the cab, hanging 10 feet below on the roadbed. This will be a complex technical rescue incident, Little reported. That meant calling in Rescue 15, a team of highly trained firefighter EMTs who respond when the unthinkable happens. An earthquake, a building collapse, a bombing, or some other disaster. He then switched to another channel to request the largest fireboat in the region. Working over the water in this weather, he needed assets below in case something or someone should fall. Meanwhile, an alert bystander had tossed a rigging strap, the kind of harness a roofer would wear over the edge of the bridge, to the driver. Police officers and civilians stood in a line holding the rope as if they were a one-sided tug-of-war. Little appreciated they wanted to help, but explained that if they pulled the driver out of the truck without the proper equipment, he was likely to tumble to his death. Once Rescue 15 got there, the team members would anchor their specialized equipment for a complex rope rescue before trying to move him. The first ladder truck arrived from the westbound side of the bridge, where traffic was still able to move. Running chains over the concrete barrier that separated the east and westbound lanes, firefighters anchored their truck to the cab's back wheels. And there's a photograph here. I mean, it's really something. I mean, it's hanging straight down. Wayne Boone, the driver, knew he should be dead, busting through the guardrail, then literally flying through the air before nosediving toward the river. It had all happened so fast. How was he still alive? Somehow, the back of his cab had snagged on the bridge's edge before it could complete its descent. Still, Strapped into his seat, he dangled a 90-degree angle above the rushing Elizabeth River, swinging with each new gust. Whatever the force was that held the cab on the edge, he knew it couldn't last. Gravity and wind would have their say. Sticky red blood spilled into his eyes. He was injured, but his body had yet to fully register the pain. He forced himself to focus. If he had any chance of escaping the cab and surviving, he had to get free from his seatbelt. The position of the cab gave little room to maneuver. The cracked windshield beneath him exposed the looming water below. If he put any weight on the glass, he risked breaking through and falling the rest of the way. Under the howl of the wind, he heard voices from above. "It's about to go." Releasing his seatbelt, Boone tried to hang onto the seat, but immediately slid into the windshield. The glass shifted in his frame. He scrambled upward, doing his best to grab pieces of the shattered dashboard, aware that he was getting cut along the way. He slipped again, and again, and again. Each time his feet met the windshield, the glass gave a little more. The next climb could be the last. Summoning all his strength, straddling broken bits of truck, he pulled himself between the seats and wedged himself back as far as he could behind the driver's seat. He had only inches of space. It would have to do. Minutes passed. To Boone, it felt like hours, before he heard the approaching sirens. To his ears, the jarring wail could have been angels singing. Somewhere in the cab, his phone rang. He would have given anything for the comfort of another human voice, but though he reached around, searching as well as he could from the cramped position, the ringing source eluded him. From the bridge above, an onlooker tossed him a harness. Boone reached out his open driver's side window and pulled it inside the cab. That effort was all he could manage. Disoriented and weak, he could not figure out how to get it on his body. The call came in to Rescue 15 at 8:43 a.m. The trio on duty at that time, Brad Gregory, 57, Justin Beasley, 25, and Mark Poag, 43, piled into the rescue truck that carried all their extrication gear and headed to the scene, running through various rescue scenarios to figure out what ropes they would need and where they should position the equipment. But their first challenge was more mundane. The sea of red brake lights that greeted them on the bridge. If this were an ordinary road, vehicles would have made way to the first whoop from the fire truck. But because the bridge had almost, at most, a 2-foot shoulder, the cars had nowhere to go. Beasley jumped up, tapped on windows, and got a few vehicles to move in order to let the rescuers pass. As they inched forward, the clock ticked on the dangling trucker. Traffic filled in behind them, cutting off the possibility of backing up and approaching from the westbound lanes, which the police had cleared. A couple hundred yards from the accident, it was clear they would get no farther. Breezy grabbed the harnesses, rope, and some other gear off the top of the rescue truck and hitched a ride on Ladder 12, a fire truck headed to the scene in the westbound lane. Pogue and Gregory gathered the rest of the equipment they expected to need from their truck. More rope, a pulley system, and a set of fours and a belay to anchor equipment to the scene. As they marched toward the crippled tractor trailer, the wind grew more intense. Rain and sleet battered them sideways, soaking them to the skin. About a dozen bystanders had left their cars, braving the storm's fury to stand vigil at the bridge's edge. Gregory, Poag, and the crew members of the ladder truck quickly devised a plan. Beasley would rappel down to the driver from the extended ladder of one of the trucks, open the door and secure the driver to himself, and then the two would be lifted to safety. By now, sustained winds were approaching 50 miles an hour with stronger gusts. Working shoulder to shoulder, they had to shout to hear each other above the howling gale. Beasley walked to the bridge's edge and tried to process. "I'm sorry, my computer just did what computers do and did a weirdy here. My apologies. I have to get back to where we were." Okay. Beasley walked to the bridge's edge and tried to process what he saw. It was like no incident he ever responded to before. Spilled diesel fuel soaked everything on the ground, including their equipment. The cab appeared to be barely holding on. Getting into his harness, Beasley checked the rope and rigging. He would be tied with an elevated anchor to prevent him from falling into the river should anything go wrong. The ladder operator positioned the fire truck's extended ladder over the top of the crippled tractor trailer and then set it in place. Ordinarily, firefighters would not raise a ladder in such high winds. It could shake the truck and wear out the metal. In theory, the wind could even blow the fire truck over. But this was as far from ordinary as it got. Poag and another firefighter had commanded the pulley system attached to the ladder. Beasley, in his harness, was fastened to the other end, working the pulleys. They lifted Beasley over the bridge's edge, maneuvered him above the cab, and slowly lowered him. As he rappelled toward the truck driver, the wind tossed Beasley like a pinball. He grabbed onto the cab to avoid being blown into the bridge. He planned to open the door and extricate the driver, but now he saw that such a move risked putting more downward pressure on the vehicle. Any rescue attempt would have to be via the window. The driver, Beasley realized, was in shock. After dangling in the wind for an hour waiting to die, he was spent. But the relief in his eyes at seeing Beasley was evident. "My name's Justin," Beasley shouted. "What's yours?" Boone replied, but Beasley barely heard him. "We're going to get you out of here," he said. He handed the harness through the open window and gave Boone step-by-step instructions for getting into it while he continued to grip the cab's side. Boone fumbled with the apparatus. He was trying to do as Beasley instructed, but he was clearly too dazed to assist in his own extraction. The wind, meanwhile, wanted to blast Beasley off the cab's door. The rescue became more precarious by the second, as 50 to 60 mile per hour gusts lashed at both the cab and the rescuer. Beasley realized there was no time left. He would have to get inside the cab. Pulling his torso through the window, he worked quickly and methodically to get each of Boone's arms and legs through the loops of the harness. Securing them to the rope system that effectively rendered them to each other, Beasley spoke reassuringly. "Come on, you can do it," he said as he grabbed the pulley and hoisted himself and the bloodied Boone through the window into the fully into the whipping winds. Pogue and a second firefighter worked the pulleys to haul them back up. As the driver and rescuer cleared the edge, cheers broke out from the crowd on the bridge. Three first responders bear-hugged both men and pulled them back over the guardrail. It was over. Paramedics bundled the injured man into an ambulance, but the storm wasn't quite done. A gust rose up and, despite the securing chains, lifted one side of Boone's empty trailer into the air and shoved it half a lane across the roadway, prompting the firefighters to evacuate the area. Boone was taken to Norfolk Centura General Hospital, having suffered lacerations and other injuries to his face, neck, and shoulder and knees. The worst damage was to his right ear, which was almost severed from his head in the crash, but doctors were able to save it. Through it all, Boone never panicked. He had accepted his fate. He was ready to go if that's what the man upstairs had in mind. But a stranger had risked his own life to save him. Hearing people shout with joy when they saw the firefighter deliver him to safety had been uplifting. In a world that could sometimes seem mean and lonely, people still cared. His heart was awash in gratitude. Back on the bridge, once Boone was safe on the ground, Beasley had reached out for a handshake. Naturally reticent and emotionally and physically drained, Boone had taken his rescuer's hand and hoped the gesture would say everything he couldn't. And there's a picture of the firefighter who dove down the thing, and he's a young, mustache, dark-haired man, 25 years old, according to the earlier thing. And Mr. Beasley was an African-American gentleman, and he got a drawing up here, and he does look scared. I can't say I blame him. I mean, he got a photograph of the truck hanging over the edge of the thing. They also got a picture of Beasley getting down and going down into the truck, actually crawling inside the truck. What a brave gentleman. Good story. And secrets of the keyboard. The longest word you can type using only the top row of a standard QWERTY keyboard is the 11-letter rupture wart. Through, proprietor, perpetuity, repertoire, and typewriter are among the more common and only slightly shorter words. The longest common word you can type using only the middle row is the 10-letter alfalfas, but the bottom row contains no vowels, which leaves only ZZZ and MMM, and even if you count those, if you even count those. Quora.com and Sheephorse is from. And now we have something from the National Interest. And the next one is called National Interest from the Comfort of Their Jail Cells. And there's a picture of a cell phone being pulled out of what appears to be a hymnal that had been where the pages had been carved out and the cell phone had been shoved into it. A diabolical scam snares every American. The real shock is it pulled off by prisoners. Like so many of us, Kaj Miller, 50, almost never answers her home phone anymore. But it rang one Saturday morning on August 2015. The caller ID read San Diego County Sheriff's Office. Since she's had a number of family members in trouble with the law over the years, she decided to pick up. Turns out that she was the one in trouble. The officer on the phone told her she had missed jury duty and there were warrants out for her immediate arrest. Miller didn't believe him. "I had just served on jury 3 months before," he says, "so I pushed back and told him I thought it was a scam. I asked to talk to a supervisor." The man on the phone promptly said no problem, gave Miller a number for the sheriff's office, and told her to ask for the court services division. When she called the number, the recording answered the San Diego County Sheriff's Office, then ran through a series of prompts. She prepped three for the service division. Captain Kerrison picked up the call and, after a pause to check her status, told her the same story. She had missed several jury duty notices. There were two warrants in circulation for her arrest. Unfortunately, because it's Saturday, if you don't work with me to pay the $980 fine, officers will come to your house and arrest with me. Miller told Garrison that there must be some mistake. He responded she was probably right, but only if the court could say so, and it was closed. Meanwhile, the warrants were still live. The way to avoid arrest was to pay the fine and then straighten things out on Monday when the court reopened. Otherwise, Miller would likely spend the rest of the weekend in jail. Miller was still skeptical, but the prospect of being arrested and spending a night or two in jail really did frighten her. At this point, I'm nervous. I'm all alone. It's mid-afternoon on Saturday. I was terrified. So she decided to follow Garrison's instructions. She drove to Walmart, as she told to do, took out a 989 MoneyGram wire, and gave Garrison the wiring information and immediate access to the money. Still on the phone, Garrison told her that only part of the money went through, so she needed to get another money order to avoid arrest. By this time, Miller had had it. After testing back and forth with Garrison, she hung up and nervously waited for the weekend. On Monday, she called the San Diego County Sheriff's Department, and an officer confirmed her fears. Captain Dwight Kerrison was actually sitting 2,200 miles away at a jail cell at Autry State Prison, a medium security facility in Pelham, Georgia. His real name, Joseph Tate. He was 2 years into serving a 40-year sentence for cocaine distribution. His cellmate, Jesse Lopez, was the first officer Miller had spoken with. He was serving a 10-year sentence at Autry for two robbery convictions. Lopez and Tate made a good team. Over a 2-year span, they had brought in more than $300,000 from the bunks of their cell by pretending to be cops and calling people around the country, pulling the jury duty scam. It's a really simple, common swindle that requires just a phone, a few apps, and a healthy dose of chutzpah. Lopez and Tate had all these tools, and they got very good at using them, playing off each other's strengths. Lopez was the researcher, staying up for days at a time, high on crystal meth that was smuggled into the prison, finding potential victims to target, and all the information about local courts and sheriffs used in the pitch. Tate, a gifted talker, was the closer. He had a knack for persuading people to send him money. He even got a retired judge to pay more than $900 so his daughter, who supposedly missed jury duty, wouldn't be sent to jail. Key to the success? The conspiracy were the cell phones smuggled into the prison. By law, inmates aren't allowed to have them, but overcoming that is often just a question of jailhouse economics. Reginald Perkerson was one of the guys recruited to join the scam, and in testimony to FBI agents, he explained how easy it was to smuggle cell phones to Autry. The most common strategy was to simply to bribe the guards. A prison guard in Georgia makes $15 to $20 an hour. As Perkins told the FBI, I can pay them $1,000 in one day for a cell phone. Who's going to take the chance? More creative ways to smuggle in cell phones included throwing them over a prison wall or even them flying them over with a hand-controlled drone. Then either corrupt guards or inmates would pick them up. Or consider the case of the old couch that was sent to a different Georgia prison so it could be reupholstered by inmates getting vocational training. More than 100 cell phones were found hidden inside. With phones in hand and endless free time, Lopez and Tate got to work. Mostly they target individuals living in wealthy neighborhoods. It's easier to get money from people who have money, Lopez later testified, and they are more likely not to want to go to jail. The internet and a smartphone made locating them a cinch. I would go to Zillow, an online real estate service, and type in a listing for something between maybe $1 million to $3 million. If I'm looking at a $1 million house, there's not going to be a trailer park right next to it. So I would just go in around the area and start calling people. Lopez liked to phone his victims late in the afternoon, hoping no one was home. He would leave a message using a VoIP, Voice Over Internet Protocol, for service to fool the caller ID so it looked as if the call came from the local police department. When the victim got home and found the message from the police, the person would pick up... When the victim got home and found a message from the police, the person would call back and once again be tricked by Lopez. He used an app that directed the call to an online call center where an automated answering service allowed him to record something like, "You have reached the Detroit Police Department. To file a police report, press 1. For civil matters, press 2. For the court services division, press 3. and if the victim pressed 3, Captain Dwight Garrison, Lopez's cellmate, responded. It was more believable if you called and heard this computer-automated voice say, "This is the police department," and give you the same rundown that any police department nationwide is going to give you, Lopez says. Once Tater Lopez got someone on the phone, the deceit continued. Lopez had downloaded a police scanner app that would play random feed of local police cars as background noise during the phone conversation. Tate and Lopez played off each other, and Lopez would be the dumb cop, pretending to only that a warrant had been issued. He would tell victims to call Tate for more information. When they called back, they would get Tate/Garrison, who was sitting right next to Lopez in their jail cell. Tate would speak more formally, asking with Court Services Division, and then take the victim through the process of securing the money to pay the fine or bond. Lopez describes Tate as incredibly persuasive, which is why he did more of the pitching and Lopez did more of the research. Convincing victims such as Miller to send money was just one part of the conspiracy. The scammers also needed someone to launder the payments. That's where Reginald Perkins came in. Perkins was a washer, the jailhouse term for a money launderer. He got the job thanks to his unique ability to befriend women on the outside, which he did by using contraband phones to access social media sites. Perkins bragged that he had about 100 women working for him across all the 50 states who would help him launder prepaid debit cards, using ones issued by a company called Green Dot and MoneyGrams. Perkins would get a $500 Green Dot card from a colleague and then call one of the girls who would take the number and convert it to 2 or 3 new debit cards. Next, she would call him back with the card numbers after taking a $100 cut for herself. Perkins told the FBI that he may have laundered as much as $1 million while he was at Autry, including money bought him by Lopez and Tate. Washing the initial payments by transferring it to different cards is important for 2 reasons. First, the inmates wanted to distance themselves from the crime as much as possible. And second, this eliminated the possibility of a victim canceling the payment. Once the scammer had the illegal proceeds loaded onto a debit card, he could use it at the prison store, trade it for drugs or contraband inside the prison, or transfer the balance to friends or family on the outside. Boy, there's a picture here of a policeman standing over a table with 23,000 cell phones confiscated from Georgia prisoners. After the police verified that she didn't have any warrants against her for missing jury duty, Cash Miller filed a detailed criminal complaint with them and notified her bank that she had been scammed. Unlike most victims, she was able to get a refund from her bank after some initial debate. But that was not the end of the matter for Miller. About 2 years later, she was contacted by FBI agents who asked whether she would fly to Atlanta to testify against 2 of the scammers. She gladly cooperated. It turns out that the FBI had investigating activities at Autry and other Georgia prisons for all that time. The Bureau had gone so far as to transfer an inmate to the prison to act as an informant. This individual told inmates at Autry that he had a contact on the outside who could launder money. What he didn't tell them that it was the guy was the lead FBI agent on the case. Over several months, the informant supplied debit cards and thousands of dollars in cash to inmates to build a case against them. He even secretly recorded Lopez and Tate practicing their scam craft. The FBI also intercepted phone calls coming out of the prison and listed it on the inmates' jail cells. Perhaps the bad guys should have seen this coming. Between 2014 and 2015, sweeps of Georgia prison facilities led to the seizure of 23,000 contraband cell phones, one for nearly every other inmate in the system. Finally, in January 2016, the U.S. Attorney in Georgia filed criminal charges against 51 individuals: Tate, Lopez, 17 other inmates, 15 prison guards, and 17 civilians. All were alleged to be part of a conspiracy to bribe guards, smuggle contraband and cell phones into prisons, defraud citizens, and launder money. Over the next 2 years, most of the 51 individuals pleaded guilty, including Lopez and Tate. The exceptions were one inmate and a female washer who fought the charges and took their case to trial. In April 2018, Lopez, as the FBI confidential informant, and Miller and 5 other victims testified against the 2. The inmate was convicted. The woman was found not guilty due to insufficient evidence. Perkins, the money launderer, pleaded guilty in August 2016 and was sentenced to nearly 13 additional years in prison. Although prosecutors were pleased by the convictions, the court found the crimes disturbing. At the sentencing, Judge Stephen C. Jones said, "When I sentence people, I say you are a danger to society, so I'm sentencing you to prison. Well, here is a person who is in prison and is still a danger to society. The amount of money that was taken, over $1 million, is mind-boggling. You're in prison, and you're able to take that much money? And there's a picture of Cash Miller, who looks like a middle-aged white lady, and she's kind of heavy-set, but she's not bad, not unattractive at all. Did the convictions teach a lesson to other inmates? Not necessarily. Several other cases have since been brought against prisoners in Georgia for perpetrating the same scam. One filed in October 2018 charged an inmate for using a contraband cell phone to pose as a U.S. Marshal and demand payment from Alabama residents for missing jury duty. And in 2019, yet another inmate at Autry pleaded guilty to committing fraud using the same scam well after his fellow prisoners had been busted. And Georgia isn't the only state to experience these kind of scams. In 2020, California inmates pulled in up to $2 billion in fraudulent unemployment benefits tied to pandemic unemployment assistance, reports the Sacramento Bee. They, too, use contraband cell phones to communicate with each other as well as with outside helpers. One of the 35,000 beneficiaries, named Scott Peterson, convicted in 2004 of the murder of his pregnant wife, Lacey. What about Lopez? After pleading guilty in December 2017 and testifying against his co-conspirators, he was sentenced to 3 years of probation in February 2020. He has made peace with his decision to testify. I caused a lot of torment, he explained, and in order for me to correct that, I've got to make amends. That means testifying against anybody, including myself, and that's what I'm willing to do. Miller doesn't have a lot of sympathy for Lopez or Tate. She also has some rather blunt for the rest of us. If someone calls and says you owe money for missing jury duty, hang up on them. How about some laughter is the best medicine? James received a bill for his recent surgery and was astonished to see $900 charge for anesthesiologist. He called the office to demand an explanation. Is this some kind of mistake? He asked when he got the doctor on the phone. Oh, not at all, the doctor replied calmly. Well, said James, irritated, that's awfully costly for just knocking someone out. Not really, replied the doctor. I knocked you out for free. The $900 is for waking you back up. St. Patrick drove all the snakes out of Ireland. They gave him a great Uber rating. For Lent, I gave up ice cream, fast food, and pizza, but obviously not lying. An executive is interviewing applicants for the position of divisional manager. He asked each applicant, what's 2 plus 2? The first interviewee was an engineer. He pulled out a slide rule and showed do people still use slide rules? And showed the answer to be between 3.99 and 4.01. He didn't get the job. The next candidate was a lawyer. She stated that in the case of Jenkins versus Brown, 2 plus 2 was proved to be 4. She also didn't get the job. The last applicant was an accountant. When the businessman asked, what's 2 plus 2? The accountant got up from his chair, closed the door, and said in a low voice, how much do you want it to be? He got the job. Kid, Mommy, why are the cars beeping their horns? Mom, because there's a wedding going on. But Mommy, isn't the horn a warning signal? Mom, exactly, son. A guy tells a psychiatrist, I have always had this weird dream. We're locked in a room. There's a door, but no matter how hard I try to push it open, it won't budge. Interesting, said the psychiatrist. And does it say anything on the door? Yes, the guy replies. It says pull. A very, very long shot. About 10% of Americans fill out the March Madness bracket for a pool at office or friends. Here are some signs you won't be any prizes for yours. You think Gonzaga is a euphemism. Your Final Four includes the University of Phoenix and Hogwarts. Your top seed, Sesame. Your which mascot would win in a fight methodology yielded a showdown between the Long Island University Ninja Pirates and the Iona Chuck Norrises. And with that, we're going to switch over to the Consumer Reports. An illegal dietary supplement is being sold to Americans, and the FDA knows it. Tenotepatine, a drug not approved for use in the U.S., has been linked to hundreds of reports of harm, including overdoses and deaths. And there's a picture of a bottle of supplement facts. And it says proprietary blend, 531 milligrams, cobertrium, quadrangular leaf, pipermethylenes, and tenotepatine. And that's obviously the dangerous drug. William Monroe, an addiction treatment specialist in Michigan, first heard about tianepatine, that's T-I-A-N-E-P-T-I-N-E, in 2016. He was treating patients across central Michigan when he learned of a problem at a local drug court, a program that focused on rehabilitating people charged with nonviolent drug crimes. Some defendants were showing up glassy-eyed and slurring words, despite having passed drug tests. People in Treedom told us what was going on. Tianeptine, a drug not approved in the U.S. and known to have a potential for abuse, was being brought in bulk online, then resold on the street. Research has found that its effects are similar to those of opioids, dulling pain and high doses causing euphoria. But as the opioid crisis prompted crackdowns on black market sales and on inappropriate prescribing of drugs such as fentanyl, and oxycodone, tianeptine has become an alternative that's cheap and easy to come by, even though the Food and Drug Administration, which regulates drugs and supplements, has made clear that those sales are illegal. Tianeptine helped fill a void, just as kratom, an ingredient in supplements that produces opioid-like effects and has been linked to multiple deaths, has done. As with kratom, tianeptine has its share of proponents who say it helps people with certain medical needs. Some U.S. companies are even planning to seek FDA approval for tianeptine as a prescription drug to treat depression. It is already approved for that use in Europe and elsewhere. Yet as companies investigate the potential of tianeptine as a legal drug, illegal supplements containing it are already widely available. The FDA has taken some steps to stop manufacturers and warn consumers. But an investigation by Consumer Reports found that the FDA's enforcement efforts have significant shortcomings. For one thing, tianeptine-related calls to poison control centers have skyrocketed. There have been at least 883 since 2015, up from 27 the decade before. And at least 4 people have died after using the drug, and almost 24 have reported hospitalization and other adverse effects, according to an analysis of FDA data, scientific case reports, and documents obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. Because many adverse events are never reported, the number is probably much higher. And that's just in the U.S. Records show that the FDA is aware of a dozen more deaths and adverse events outside the country. This is a terrible example of the FDA being absolutely behind on ensuring the safety of supplements, says Peter Cohen, M.D., a Harvard Medical School associate professor who studies dietary supplements. Tianeptine's emergence illustrates serious problems with how the FDA regulates its $46 billion dietary supplement industry. Unlike prescription drugs, supplements generally don't need FDA approval to be introduced for sale. Courtney Rhodes, an FDA spokesperson, declined to answer CR's questions about the tianeptine manufacturers, but she says the agency has no systematic way of knowing what dietary supplement products are on the market or what ingredients they contain. Because we cannot put an investigator in every store in every state and we do not have constantly updating window into every retail corner of the Internet, stakeholders become our eyes and ears, and we are left trying to play catch-up, she says. Chuck Bell, who has advocated for safer supplements for more than 20 years at CR, says the flagrant sale of an illegal drug such as tianeptine as a supplement is unacceptable. These manufacturers are intentionally skirting the law, and they know tianeptine is an unregistered pharmaceutical drug, which by definition cannot be a dietary ingredient in the U.S., he says. Abuse and addiction. After being developed in the 1960s in France, tianeptine's potential use for abuse eventually led to some countries, such as Russia, to classify it as a controlled substance, limiting access to it. Tonix Pharmaceuticals, a drug maker planning to seek FDA approval for tianeptine, recognizes that risk of high doses. That's a liability, says Gregory Sullivan, M.D., the chief medical officer at Tonix, which is based in New Jersey. To counter that danger, the company proposes adding small amounts of naloxone, a drug used to treat opioid overdoses, in its tianeptine pill. Some experts attribute tianeptine's rise in popularity in the U.S. in part to a 2014 study in the journal Transitional Psychiatry, which found that the drug can have effects similar to those of opioids. As early as 2015, FDA records show companies were importing tianeptine into the U.S. soon after tianeptine supplements emerged under the brand names such as TNA and Zaza. Gas stations became common sellers. Some tianeptine users also obtained it in bulk from online vendors that sell it with an apparent wink and a nod as for research purposes only. Brandon Lackey, executive administrator of a network of drug recovery centers in Alabama, says he has found patients treated for opioid addiction turning to tianeptine instead, only to find themselves then addicted to that substance. The law does not allow a timely enough response to keep emerging health threats from becoming health crises, he says. On the social media site, Reddit, many self-reported tianeptine users have gathered on forums such as quitting tianeptine and shared reasons for taking it, including its potential medicinal benefits. Indeed, William Rustin, M.D., medical director for the Alabama Poison Information Center, says very few of the patients I've encountered are starting TN-Epteane to get a recreational high, but rather are truly trying to help themselves under a mistaken concept of its safety. The outcomes of use can be severe. In October 2019, a 25-year-old Illinois man with a history of depression died at a local hospital after taking TN-Epteane, according to a report obtained by CR. The man's family didn't respond to a request for comment. It's unclear why Colby Brennan turned to TN-Epteane, but according to a lawsuit later filed by his family, the decision proved to be fatal. The 28-year-old Texas resident purchased the substance in July 2015 from Powder City, a company that sells supplements online, according to the lawsuit. After receiving his order and ingesting the substance, he died from what investigators conclude were the toxic effects of TN-Epteane. Powder City did not respond to a request for comment. Steve Kaus, an attorney who represented the Brennan family, declined to comment, cited a confidentiality agreement reached as part of a settlement. In March 2016, Powder City apparently stopped selling TN-Epteane. The reason, according to the lawsuit, people were misusing it. Worse than heroin. Around that time, more than 1,300 miles into the north in Michigan, Alyssa Wood was introduced to TN-Epteane. In the spring of 2016, Wood was a few years into the recovery from opioid abuse. But friends said TN-Epteane was safe. Soon she was using it, eventually even injecting it. "I'm surprised how easy it was to get," she says. Her friends would order it online, and within a few days it would come by mail. Withdrawal and detox was 10 times more severe than any opiate withdrawal, she says. In 2017, when Michigan law enforcement opened an investigation into TN-Epteane, it came to a similar conclusion. Many users describe it as worse than heroin, says Shannon Banner, a state police spokesman. In 2018, Wood provided testimony to the Michigan State Legislature. It was kiddishing a bill that would list TN-Epteane as a Schedule II controlled substance, meaning if the FDA were to approve it as a prescription drug, it would be regulated the same as opioids. She described how daily injections left her arms with abscesses that required surgery. "She spent a week in the hospital, terrified about all the open sores and cuts on my body," Wood told lawmakers. Michigan passed the bill, and soon after, some local TN-Epteane dealers went out of business, says Moreau, the Recovery Services Director. "They knew that the law was now specific enough to show that they were committing a crime," he says. But outside of Michigan, business was continuing largely unhindered. Scratch that opioid itch. In Alabama, for example, TN-Epteane arrived like a flood, Lackey says. It wasn't a question of whether or not it was going to be a problem. It was a problem from the beginning. As word about TN-Epteane got around, Lackey says use skyrocketed. A resident of Lackey's rehab program smuggled it in, and he and his cabin mates would go in therapy, high as a kite. "It's a way to scratch that opioid itch without getting caught," Lackey says, referring to the fact that drug blood tests don't screen for TN-Epteane. "They think that because it's sold over the counter that it's legal, and that's okay. It's safe, but it's not. Once you scratch that opioid itch, it doesn't go away." Lackey spent 2 years pushing Alabama lawmakers to ban TN-Epteane. In mid-2020, the Alabama Department of Public Health announced a new rule listing it as a Schedule II substance. The rule was supposed to go into effect in November until the maker of Tiana filed suit. In that lawsuit, the company Premier Manufacturing Product argued that Alabama businesses would suffer financially if they were unable to keep selling it. Premier also argued that TN-Epteane could legally be sold as a supplement, because the government had yet to schedule it as a controlled substance, a claim contradicted by federal law as well as the FDA's stated position that it's illegal to sell supplements that include TN-Epteane as an ingredient. The FDA declined to answer questions about the Premier's claim, saying it can't comment on potential or ongoing investigations. James Morissette, a Premier executive, asserted that the letter sent to the ADPH in 2020 that listed TN-Epteane as a Schedule II drug could hurt supplement manufacturers. But industry groups say companies like Premier give supplements a bad rep. "Any company selling a product containing TN-Epteane as a supplement is putting consumers' health at risk," says Steve Mister, president of the Council for Responsible Nutrition. Boy, that's an interesting last name, Mister. Yet Morissette's legal maneuver worked. In November, the ADPH withdrew its proposed rule on TN-Epteane until it produced a report detailing how a ban on it would affect companies selling it in the state, says ADPH spokesman Errol Sheenan. "That has effectively allowed the sale of an illegal supplement to continue while the state sorts how much money businesses make on it." J. David Martin, an attorney representing Premier, declined to comment. A spokesman for Premier acknowledged CR's request for comment, but had not provided answers at press time. Even if Alabama's ban ultimately goes into effect, Rushton, at the state's Poison Control Center, worries that many users may just go across the straight lines to buy it. Morissette, in fact, has reportedly advocated against discussions in neighboring Florida to classify tianeptine as a Schedule II drug. In an interview with Florida's CBS station, he said that many of his customers use tianeptine for pain and anxiety, but perhaps unwittingly, he also conceded that tianeptine is also used for other reasons. A solid percentage of them are using it for opiate sensations, he says. Stronger enforcement is needed. As Alabama's tianeptine problem was ballooning in 2018, the FDA issued a press release warning that supplements containing the drug were highly addictive. Over the past year, at least two individuals have been indicted by the federal government for attempting to sell tianeptine in the U.S. But industry groups and dietary supplement watchdogs alike say the FDA could be doing more. They just need more enforcement resources and more enforcement tools in the toolbox, says Laura McCleary, policy director for the Center for Science in the Public Interest, CSPI, a consumer advocacy group. Daniel Fabricant, Ph.D., president of the Natural Products Association, a supplemental industry group, and a former director of the FDA's Supplements Division, says the agency needs more aggressively to use tools it has. He says that it could issue an import alert, which would stop tianeptine shipments at the border. The FDA could also ask courts to issue injunctions against companies marketing tianeptine and could seize products it finds being sold. Clearly, though, Fabricant says, the FDA's actions on tianeptine to date haven't been a big enough deterrent. For example, in late 2018, the agency sent warning letters to two companies selling tianeptine supplements, essentially calling them to clean up their act or risk legal action. While such letters are among the strongest tools available to the agencies, recipients sometimes treat them like traffic tickets, and the FDA doesn't always follow up. That's what happened when FDA warned Jack B. Goods Outlet, an online retailer that sold Tiana, to stop selling the supplement, especially while making claims that it was an unparalleled solution for cravings for opiates. Yet Jack B. Good appears to continue to sell tianeptamine, and there is no indication in agency records reviewed by CR of additional enforcement action taken by the FDA. Jack B. Goods did not respond to requests for comment. Seeking solutions. McCleary, along with CR advocates, says tianeptamine's continued availability underscores the need for a supplement registry that would require companies to submit to FDA a product's name, its ingredients, and contact information when taking a supplement to market. If the company submits a product with an illegal ingredient, the FDA could say from the outset that it may not be sold. And if the AG finds an unregistered supplement, it could quickly start enforcement action and notify retailers to pull it off the shelves. The FDA says that it supports a registry, but it lacks the authority to create one. Federal lawmakers have proposed legislation to give the FDA that power at least twice since 2011, but those bills have not been acted on. Fabricant doesn't think a registry is needed because that the FDA already has the resources it needs. This is something where the agency has to uphold the laws, he says. CR's bill says the registry would help, but it is not enough. With over 80,000 supplements in the marketplace, Congress needs to enhance the FDA's authority, he says. If we want the FDA to act quickly to remove unsafe products, it will need more funding and staff. The CSPI and Lackey, the Alabama Recover Services Director, called on the FDA in August to take additional action against tianeptine. The agency is reviewing the letter, says FDA spokesman Rhodes. One option would be for the FDA to approve tianeptine as a prescription drug. If it does, steps taken by Michigan as well as Minnesota and Oklahoma to list tianeptine as a controlled substance would sharply restrict access to the ingredient. Maroney, the Michigan addiction treatment specialist, says the state's legislative efforts have helped rein in tianeptine sales. We wanted to make sure that it wasn't going to enter the mainstream of drugs. While Michigan may have found success, people could still find tianeptine in a matter of seconds online. In early December, one eBay seller noted on their website that they made dozens of Zaza supplement sales to consumers and were even offering buyers a deal, a discount for purchasing multiple bottles with free shipping. Other dietary supplements with risky ingredients. Tianeptine isn't the only ingredient some dietary supplements that the FDA has said should not be in those products. CR found a number of supplements for sale in December 2020 that contained at least one such ingredient, including these 10 listed with their manufacturers. Fastin XR High Tech Pharmaceuticals contained methylsenonephrine, a stimulant used to improve oxygen exchange. Neopil, called in nutrition, contained piracetam, purported to improve cognitive function. Nocamelion LifeLink contained picamelion, a drug described in other countries for neurological conditions. Green Stinger, Schwartz Laboratories, contains Archaea rigidula, a plant used in some weight loss supplements. Friction, VPX Bang Energy, contained isoproloproctoprotamine, a stimulant used and known as Adderall. Anesthetized Blackstone Labs contained Phenibut, used in Russia as an anti-anxiety medication. They must use a lot of it over there. pH Balancer Plus, American Nutraceuticals, contains cesium chloride, a substance promoted as an alternative cancer treatment. Militov X from Millicor contained DMHA, a stimulant marketed for weight loss and athletic performance. Thermosculpt Original, designed by Dean, contained BMPEA, a synthetic substitute for amphetamines. Excuse me. These words are very difficult. Adiprofen Ultra, 8 week out, contains DMAA, an amphetamine derivative. LifeLink and Bang Energy say they no longer sell the products listed above. Hitech says the FDA's position, which it disputes, is not final. Other companies could not be reached or did not respond to requests for comment. Protect your credit score, especially in the pandemic. Reporting errors are piling up and consumers are being wrongfully penalized. To keep your credit healthy, here's what you must do. Josh Thomas, a self-employed computer programmer in Port Orchard in Washington, was worried about his job prospects after 3 months in lockdown because of COVID-19. So last May, he signed up online for an offer from his credit card company, Barclays Bank, to defer his monthly payments for up to 3 months. But 3 months later, Thomas discovered that his credit score had dropped after checking his credit reports. Those detailed credit histories produced by the big credit bureaus, Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion, are used by companies like FICO and the VantageScore to calculate the three-digit credit score. And that score is used by lenders when deciding whether to offer credit cards and auto, home, and student loans to consumers and what interest rates to charge. Thomas saw that Barclays had erroneously reported he missed a credit card payment in July during his deferral period. He filed his dispute claims with each credit bureau to correct the error, but was unsuccessful. He finally sued Barclays in September as part of a class action lawsuit in an effort to remove the late payment from his reports. The case is still pending. Having a lower credit score meant that Thomas had to delay starting a nonprofit business he hoped to get off the ground, says Chris Rocheford, his attorney. As a growing number of Americans face job losses and economic insecurity during the pandemic, more people than ever are reporting errors on their credit reports. Already in precarious financial situation, even more so. Complaints to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau about credit report errors have reached record levels. According to the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, a consumer advocacy and policy organization, these errors have long posed a problem for consumers. The best and biggest study on the issue, done by the Federal Trade Commission in 2012, found that 1 in 4 consumers had at least one error in their reports. But the COVID-19 crisis has worsened the situation, says Syed Ayaz, a financial policy consultant at Consumer Reports. This is a problem that existed long before the pandemic, he says, but it's made more harmful and urgent because of its limits access to affordable credit and financing to people who have been financially impacted by COVID-19. Part of the problem stems unintentionally from the CARES Act, which was passed by Congress last March as a way to help people struggling during the pandemic, says Chi-Chi Wu, senior policy counsel at the National Consumer Law Center, NCLC, a profit group based in Boston, a nonprofit group. The law requires certain companies that provide federally backed mortgages and student loans to offer deferred payments but report them as current to ease financial pressure on consumers. Other businesses, like credit card companies and auto lenders, have voluntarily offered deferrals. But some companies have erroneously reported those deferred payments as late. And in some cases, loans have been granted forbearance, which is a different kind of temporary pause on payments, have also been reported as late. Ali Hafez of Rahway, New Jersey, qualified for 6 months of delayed payments on her student loan under the CARES Act. But according to a class action lawsuit filed last July, the company that serviced her loan, Navient, erroneously reported to the credit bureaus that her payments, as well as those for thousands of other people, were late, even though the CARES Act required Navient to report them as up to date. The error resulted in a 97-point drop in Hafez's credit score. Another problem, Wu says, is that credit bureaus don't have to respond as quickly to consumer disputes as they used to. Pre-COVID-19, the law stated that bureaus had a 30-day window. In April 2020, the CFPB relaxed the rule, but provided no alternative time frame, saying only the company had to make a good-faith effort. Consumer complaints about slow response times have increased significantly, Wu points out. Consumers lost over 13,000 complaints just in the past 6 months, saying that their disputes are not addressed within 30 days, she says. That compares with just 2,000 similar complaints in 2019, a 550% increase. The victims of this pandemic are not the companies the CPFB is losing reins on, says Ed Mayeriski, Senior Director for Federal Consumer Programs at USPRG, who has studied CFPB consumer complaints. They are real people who face the risk of getting sick at the same time as they're having trouble paying their bills. The agency says that for 2020, complaints about consumer credit reports accounted for more than 50% of all complaints, many of which focus on incorrect information on credit reports, says a spokesman for the agency. The second most common issue is problems with credit reporting companies' investigation into an existing problem. Credit bureaus and financial institutions remain responsible for conducting reasonable investigations of consumer disputes in a timely fashion, the CFPB spokesperson added. The bureau expects them to make good-faith efforts to investigate disputes as quickly as possible. Far-reaching consequences. Credit reporting agencies work behind the scenes, but they know a lot about you. Banks, credit card and mortgage companies, auto lenders, and others send the agency data about the payment and borrowing activity of millions of consumers every day. Whether you pay a loan or debt on time, you're sought to open new line of credit, even for information about old credit card accounts. All of this gets captured under rules governed by the Fair Credit Reporting Act of 1970. Given the volume of data, some errors are bound to happen, according to Sierra Zajas. But the number of mistakes is unacceptable, he says. Especially now when so many people are on the brink of financial disaster. The problem isn't just errors stemming from COVID-19 related deferred payments. Other common errors, such as accounts and loans that have been paid off but still appear as unpaid, individual loans reported multiple times, or debt that's listed as in collections but has been paid off, can pose hurdles if you need a loan or a line of credit, says Andy Miltz, a consumer protection attorney at the law firm Flitter Miltz in Philadelphia. Even a wrong address can get you in trouble. For example, Alec Ozols, a San Diego attorney, had superb credit. But in April 2020, as he was applying for a mortgage, a routine check revealed that his score dropped nearly 80 points, potentially affecting the mortgage term. The culprit, a 2-year-old unpaid ticket Ozols received when driving a rental car. A collections agency had sent notice to him at an old address still listed in the rental company's system. Fortunately, Ozols was able to quickly fix the problem and get favorable terms on the mortgage. Other kinds of mistakes can be more serious. Situations involving mixed files, when information from someone with a similar name or social security number is reported as yours, or if you've been the victim of identity theft and had accounts fraudulently opened in your name, can be particularly difficult to untangle. Meanwhile, you could be prevented from getting any kind of loan or credit card. Your credit scores matters even if you aren't seeking a loan. Potential landlords, cell phone and cable companies, and employers might view that information, says Edward Y. Kraub at Consumer Attorneys in Brooklyn, New York, which specialize in finance litigation. That information can be used to decide how much to charge you, how much a deposit to require, and whether you'll be hired for a job. Even similarly minor errors can have a big impact on credit score. When Jane Axon and her husband Alex went to purchase a home in Skokie, Illinois in March 2020, she knew that their bank would need access to their credit reports, which had frozen years before to approve a mortgage. As the clock ticked, Jane spent days scrambling to get her husband's report unfrozen, to no avail. Finally, she discovered the source of the problem. Her husband's birth date was off by a single digit in the report. It was corrected, but Axon says it shouldn't be this hard. Are fixes coming? Increasing credit reporting problems due to the pandemic became clear. Some states took steps to solve the problem. Last April's attorneys general in 21 states plus Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico wrote a letter to the CFPB urging it to reconsider its relaxed 30-day policy for credit bureau disputes, saying that those states would enforce a 30-day period on their own. But according to Francis Creighton, president and CEO of Consumer Data Industry Association, which represents the credit bureaus, the credit reporting industry has been meeting the 30-day deadline. Multiple bills in Congress could relieve consumers' pain. Two of them address credit report accuracy and consumer protections. The one introduced by Representative Josh Gontner, passed the House on June, requires that a full Social Security number match what's on a creditor's claim and a person's credit report. The current standard practice is to match just the 7 of the 9 digits, which can lead to file mix-ups. The second bill, introduced by Anna Pressley, Democrat, Massachusetts, and passed in the House last January, would formalize the right of consumers to appeal a dispute decision, provide credit restoration for victims of fraud, and create an ombudsman person at CFPB to handle persistent errors. For now, the surest way to quickly catch bad information on your report is to check it frequently, especially if you made any special arrangements with the lenders or credit card companies, says Bruce McClary, Senior Vice President of Communications at the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. To do that, go to theannualcreditreport.com to request a free credit report from each of the three credit bureaus. The agencies are provided free weekly online reports until April 2021. Another option is to use a free credit report monitoring app like Credit Karma that allows you changes in your score. That's how Andy Cunningham had discovered that a hospital had checked his credit report multiple times in error when he was setting up a payment plan to settle a bill, dinging his score. Because he detected a change in the report almost immediately, Cunningham says he was able to address the problem quickly. How to fix your credit report errors. Prepare dispute materials of each credit bureau. Gather evidence with debtors reported incorrectly, include account statements or payment records. Create a paper trail. Write a letter explaining the problem using standardized online forms provided by the credit bureaus, which might amplify your dispute by requiring you to choose among predetermined checkboxes. Send all materials by certified mail, and keep copies for yourself. This makes it easier to confirm that the credit bureaus follow the lawful timelines. If you win your dispute, ask for corrections. At your request, the bureaus must send an updated report to anyone who's checked your credit in the past 6 months. Guard against recurring errors. Sometimes errors that have been fixed can wind up back on your report. If this happens, you'll need to dispute the error again. If you lose your dispute, consider working with an experienced attorney. You can sue a credit bureau or financial institutions over credit reporting errors. If a company is found in violation, your legal fees will be automatically covered, Kalb says, noting that most law firms won't require payment up front to review your case. Find an attorney through the National Association of Consumer Advocates at consumeradvocates.org. In case of identity theft, you have additional rights, including the right to obtain detailed documentation about accounts improperly opened in your name. Add a personal statement to your report. It can provide context and explain the corrective steps you tried. File a complaint with the Consumer Protection Financial Protection Bureau at consumerfinance.gov if you think the outcome of your dispute was unfair. And with that, we've just about run out of time for today's episode of the Reader's Digest of Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so much for listening.